Words About Dune is a poorly spoken podcast about Dune. It's a four-episode podcast series about a book with only three parts.
You hope it's four episodes.
It stars amazing characters such as the Shoutout Mapes, Dr. Wellington Yue, Lingar Butte the Water Magnate, Umang Kudo the Guard Captain, Duke Leto Atreides, Tuik the Smuggler, Susu the Guild Banker, and Peter DeVry. Oh, no, actually, all those people are dead. That's my bad. Well, it also stars important characters such as the planetologist Liet Kynes, Duncan Idaho, Gurney Halleck, Thufir Hawat, Count Faring, and the lady Countess Margot Fenring.
Fenring, yes.
Fenring. And I'm sure those guys are going to stick around and have a lasting impact on this book. I am Nate, and as always, I'm joined by co-host Ben. How are you doing?
I'm doing pretty good. I feel like maybe you were being disingenuous there. I don't think you're actually excited about all those characters.
I don't know what you're talking about.
What's
Jason Momoa landing that part.
Hey, if they ever get into the sequels, I know I keep saying this. Like... If we ever get to the sequels, Duncan Idaho is perhaps the most important character in Dune. Just not in this book.
Just not in Dune, but in Dune the series. Yeah, just not in Dune. Yeah. The listeners are not aware of this, but you keep insisting in our personal correspondence that it gets good. You just have to go like 800 plus pages into the series.
You know, it's Dune is in many ways like a marriage. It requires commitment and understanding and patience, and it fills the painful void and prevents you from thinking about how we all probably die. Actually, it doesn't. It mentions that all the time. We do all die alone. But
so yeah, last episode we discussed the death of Duke Leto. And the reveal that there was a traitor in the Atreides household, and that despite all non-evidence to the contrary, said traitor was in fact Dr. Yue.
I don't know how they broke his conditioning.
They did. Go back and listen to that podcast if you don't know what we're talking about. And then listen to it a couple more times, and then download it on three devices.
And give anyway, us a five-star review on iTunes. Yeah. Do people still do that?
You can write five stars on a letter and mail it to us. We also mentioned that Yue had arranged the capture of Paul and Jessica, as well as mechanisms for their escape prior to being murdered by Peter. So that he managed to get them away and into the desert, and also he got the signet ring and Duncan Idaho. Do we get to Duncan Idaho picking them up?
No, that's in this episode.
Oh, shit.
All
right.
That's why when you were like, Duncan Idaho, all these people are not yet. They're not.
Yeah, that's why I said, you know, the next part, Duncan Idaho, he'll be a great addition to the book. He's going to play a huge role.
He is, actually.
In this book, totally.
Yeah, I mean, kind of. I could make a very long argument that he does.
All right. Well, you seem excited. I'll let you go then.
To kick off this episode, we're going to rewind a bit to the same timeline that we discussed in the previous episode, but from a different perspective. This time, we're going to talk about the perspective of Paul and Jessica as House Atreides was being ripped apart by the Baron and Dr. Yue. Jessica awakes in a dark room. And she quickly realizes that she's been drugged and that she is restrained. So using her Bene Gesserit techniques, she's able to quickly calm herself and regain control over her senses. And Jessica resolves to use a trick out of Paul's book and pretend to be asleep so that she can look for an opportunity to act. But her feint does not succeed because they just can't give Jessica a win.
To be fair, she doesn't deserve a win.
Ouch. This is
anyway,
this,
keep going.
You know, I just finished editing Head Full of Ghost, and this is just Mary all over again.
I have more compassion for Mary than I have for Jessica.
You're at least like Mary as a child.
Yeah.
So four men enter the dark room that Jessica is in, and a deep voice informs her that he is indeed aware that she is awake and aware that she is merely feigning unconsciousness. And of course, it is none other than the Baron Vladimir Harkonnen.
The jiggling man himself.
He tells Jessica that the drug she was given was timed, and it is timed to the exact moment she would wake up. And Jessica's baffled. She's like, how could that be? In order to have timed the dosage that precisely, they would have needed to know a variety of personal medical details. And the only one who would know those details would be some sort of personal doctor to the Atreides family. And it's at this point that Jessica begins to suspect Yui may have been coerced into helping.
He may have been the traitor. It's a distinct possibility.
And so the Baron has taken special precautions against both the voice and maintaining plausible deniability regarding what is about to happen here in the event that he is questioned by a Bene Gesserit truthsayer. Now, Nate, I would like to engage in a little non-sexual role play with you.
Damn it. Okay.
I would like you to pretend to be the Baron. And I'm going to be the Bene Gesserit truthsayer. And so I'm going to see if I can tell if you had anything to do with this crime. Now you,
all right,
left the room before anything bad happened to any of these people. So you, when you tell me that you didn't kill them, you won't actually be lying. So let's see how this goes. Baron.
Yes. I'm jiggling. If you can't tell.
I can tell. I can. Yes. So, Baron, did you kill Paul Atreides?
No.
Baron, one more question. Did you arrange circumstances such that Paul Atreides would be in danger of his life?
Okay, now you're going to have to define circumstances.
Were you perhaps in any way involved in the situation that led to Paul Atreides' death?
Okay, now when you say involved, what are we talking here?
Did you happen to take an army to Arrakis and kill literally everyone except Paul Atreides? And now you own Arrakis, so I know you did that.
Good question. I want a lawyer.
Ah, shit. Well, I tried, Emperor. He asked for a lawyer. So it was truly a foolproof plan. But yes, the Baron excuses himself because he must maintain plausible deniability and admit only to killing everyone in Paul's household, but not Paul or Jessica. Yeah,
it worked out well just now when we did some role play.
Yeah, you lawyer up, you plead the fifth.
It works out.
Just deny, deny, deny.
No court could convict you based on circumstantial evidence that you murdered a bunch of other dudes adjacent to the guy who you are claiming you didn't kill.
So Piter and the Baron leave to go get gassed by Leto's fancy new tooth, as we described in the previous episode.
Go listen to it.
And Jessica is tossed into a waiting ornithopter by two guards. Now, these guards were selected specifically for this task. And you might be surprised to learn that this task is not to just shoot Jessica. It is to instead, in some sort of James Bond-esque complicated plot, take them out to the desert and leave them there and let the desert take care of them. Because that way, if the desert, and this is actually in the book, I love this book, by the way. I'm really sorry. I don't want to have to do this. But I got to do this because this is our podcast. So they take her out to the desert to let the desert kill them because, and I quote, that won't leave any evidence. Now, Baron, as you may remember from your interview with the truthsayer, you didn't own Arrakis, and now all the Atreides are dead and you do own Arrakis. And how did that happen again?
So I walked in on Duke Leto, and he gassed himself, right? And then Paul and Jessica gave Arrakis to me by way of going into the desert and not returning.
So could we like go out into the desert and look for them now?
No, there's no evidence of them.
But they're okay.
Possibly. I don't know. I wasn't there.
Ah, shit. He's telling the truth. He wasn't there. Well, you get away with this one, Baron.
Get away with? I've done nothing wrong.
Shut up, you fat bastard. Now, they throw a gagged Paul into the ornithopter as well. Oh, no, actually, I'm sorry.
No,
I'll take
that
back.
He's not gagged.
He's not gagged, yes, because they knew Jessica had the power of the voice, but they don't suspect that Paul was trained similarly, even though they mention that Paul was trained similarly. But the good news is, and this is something honest to God, I did not pick up on until my second reading of this book. The two guards, they choose two guards, but one of them is deaf and therefore immune to the powers of the voice. Now, what you may find is weird about the next section of this book is that the deaf guard and the other guard have just a full normal conversation.
I don't see what's wrong with that. What are you talking about?
Like the deaf guard, at first I was like, well, maybe he's really good at reading lips. And then I'm thinking, like, it's dark. He's piloting a helicopter.
I don't see what's wrong with this. This makes perfect sense.
It was just odd. It was just very odd. I don't have corona. I'm fine. This is our first episode we're recording in the post-corona world.
Oh, yeah. This is also the first episode I'm recording from my new house. So if my audio sounds bad, blame the house. It's not my fault.
The guards are having a very polite conversation regarding all the non-consensual things that they would like to do to Jessica, and that, you know, it's a shame that she has to die, waste of a pretty face and all that. So it's at this point Jessica notices that the seat belts, which they've so kindly been buckled into, I wouldn't want them to get hurt in a crash, are rigged and they are easily breakable. So once the thopter lands outside the shield wall on the desert sands, Paul attempts to use the voice. He orders the guards who can hear to untie his mother. And that guard begins to do so, despite his deaf colleague's protest. Immediately then, Jessica uses the voice to force them to knife fight each other to the death.
If only all of them had been deaf.
Yeah.
Or, you know, if they had like earplugs or something.
It's very strange that the Baron is like, I know all about your Bene Gesserit tricks. That's why I got one deaf guard to keep an eye on the one hearing enabled guard. And why not just have two deaf guards? Or just one guard who is deaf? Why not? Anyway. They untie Paul because so they knife fight to the death, and then I guess the guard that wins is the one that can hear. I can't tell though, because again everybody has normal conversations. So Jessica is then like, well, you should at least untie my son. And he's like,
so that he can participate. I don't understand what.
So Jessica, yeah. So Jessica wants him untied specifically so that, you know, at least give him a chance. He's probably not going to survive in the desert, but at least give him a chance. And besides, if we're going to do this, trust me, you want me to be willing, because the Bene Gesserit know a few tricks, and that's enough for him to be like, okay, I'll untie your stupid son. So he unties Paul, who then promptly kicks him to death.
Yeah, hold on. He kicks him in the aorta and seemingly like blows his heart up. Don't gloss over that.
Paul Mortal Kombat finishes this guy.
He ruins this guy's heart.
And Paul and Jessica, using all their Bene Gesserit training, decide to go over all their resources and take stock of the situation. Paul and Jessica spot that Yui's house sign is carved. He's never, I don't know what his house sign is. He's never been mentioned as having a house. I don't even, I guess Yui is his, Wellington Yui. So the Yui house sigil is carved into the front.
The house of one person.
And like, I don't know, like, you know how in Game of Thrones they had like sigils and like there was a dire wolf and they're simple and everything, but like in what sense would it be easier to like carve that into a roof than just like, you know, WY or like, unless he's got like a very simple sigil that he like he's very, he just brands everything.
Maybe so, he has one pre-made. It's like a giant,
it's like a stamp. So Paul and Jessica spot that UA's sign is on this Thopter. You know, he's always working on that brand. And they find a bundle of desert survival gear under the pilot seat. But before they can investigate it any farther, a second Thopter descends. Fortunately, though, this was another aspect of Yui's plan to spare Paul and Jessica. The Thopter is piloted by none other than Duncan Idaho.
Oh my god. How did he sell him on this plan? Like, hey, buddy, you should be in the desert tonight. Can't tell you why. And you need to rescue... you need to just go to these coordinates and pick up two people from there. Just trust me on this one. Well, nothing bad is going to happen.
I imagine as things started blowing up and thousands of elite Sardaukar warriors began invading the compound, going the other way seemed like, you know, I better check out what that guy was talking about. Just you guys hold it here, and I'm going to go see, see what that desert was all about.
You guys got this. Don't worry. I'm going to go to the desert now.
So no, I won't actually joke about this. I will not sully Duncan Idaho. He's a great man.
With a great name.
He does have a really bad name. This is where things really start to kick off. So Jessica is having a moment of panic before the Thopter lands. She thinks that the Baron sent two groups, which maybe he should have, but
this one is just full of all deaf and blind people.
Paul, on the other hand, a strange thing is happening to Paul. And this is where I really begin to love Dune. This is the stuff I came here for.
Hold on. Wait just a moment. We're like 300 pages in, and this is where you start to like Dune.
Well, where did you start to like Dune?
Like halfway into part three.
Yes, this is where I start to like Dune, and I should probably state that I knew a lot about Dune before I read it, and this was the stuff I was really looking forward to.
Okay.
As Paul is looking at the Ornithopter descend, he recognizes that the pilot is none other than Duncan Idaho, just simply from the piloting style. And his brain kind of like snaps, and he's really quiet and silent for a bit. In the meantime, Duncan moves Jessica and Paul to a more secure location in the desert while he looks for a more permanent place for them. Jessica and Paul are sitting in a still tent, which is a temporary Fremen structure made for camping in the desert during the heat of the day. They are reading a note left to them by Yui, which also contains the ducal signet ring. And it is, I think, really best to probably just give a direct reading of what happens here.
Across the still tent from Paul, Jessica stirred. She said, "There can be only one explanation. The Harkonnens held Yui's wife. He hated the Harkonnens. I cannot be wrong about that. You read his note, but why has he saved us from the carnage?" And Paul thinks, "She is only now seeing it. And that poorly." The thought was a shock. He had known this fact as a by-the-way thing while reading the note that had accompanied his ducal signet ring in the pack. "Do not forgive me," Yue had written. "I do not want your forgiveness. I already have enough burdens. What I have done was done without malice or hope of another's understanding. It is my own Tahadi al-Burhan, my ultimate test. I give you the Atreides ducal signet as a token that I write truly. By the time you read this, Duke Leto will be dead. Take consolation from my assurance that he did not die alone, that the one we hate above all others has died with him.
Ha! Wrong again, idiot!
Yes, as we mentioned in the previous episode, the Baron does unfortunately survive the suicide. Yeah, I guess the Leto's murder-suicide
gassing.
The Lady Jessica is supposed to be very smart and observant and trained in all these secret Bene Gesserit arts. And we've been making fun of it a bit, but what Frank Herbert was trying to get across is that the student has sort of become the master here. Jessica taught Paul everything he knows about situational analysis and data analytics and all that. And he is now operating just on a different wavelength from her. The things she's just now figuring out, he barely even remembers figuring out. And Paul also notices that he can't quite feel anything correctly emotionally. He's struggling to mourn his father's death. The information and sense impressions he's gathering are just important data points to him. He can attach an appropriate weight to the information, but he can't feel the emotional impact of it. And all the while, he's just continuously surprised by Jessica's inability to keep up.
Because she's bad. I don't know. You see this a lot in works of fiction, where someone becomes like super smart and then they can't relate to people, but like the emotional control is in your brain. I don't care.
I definitely know as a writer of a bad story that has a hero that's supposed to be like a super smart, super fast information processing guy, it's a lot easier to show that by making everyone else dumb than it is to think of smart things for that person to do, because then I have to be smart.
Would Dave have figured out who the traitor was?
Dave would
or that
have.
There was a traitor?
Yes, he would have. And it would have been magic, and I would have described a lot of fun ways that his head hurt.
And then all the other characters around him would be drooling.
All the other characters around him would be like, oh my God, how did you put that together? Except Carl, who would be like, I also figured that out. I don't know why Carl's effeminate.
Yeah, you do.
That's not how I write him. No, I write him. Carl is hetero as fuck. So Paul senses that something has changed in his awareness of reality and is continuing to evolve. He feels that it is deeply connected to his sense of terrible purpose. And Jessica, for her part, is also noticing Paul is being kind of a jerk.
Wow, Paul's being a little weird.
And she's like, are you sad that your dad died? Do you need a soda?
But no, she doesn't have that much insight. Let's be real.
He's acting very strange. He's cold and calculating. He's commanding. He is no longer asking Jessica what they should do or treating her as any kind of authority figure or indeed parent. He's telling her what to do. And she's beginning to become a little afraid of him.
She might have to ground him to his still tent.
I actually think that the fear Jessica starts to develop now of Paul is something that kind of persists throughout the rest of the series, not even just this book. I think this is a fundamental shift in Jessica and Paul's relationship. I'm not sure if you would say that or if you care.
I would say that it's her fault.
Jessica is just sort of trying to move things along and focus on what their next steps are going to be. So Jessica is hopeful that some sort of Atreides force will survive the initial attack and that maybe they could rally a counterattack. Overall, she's suggesting a lot of sort of optimistic and kind of pie in the sky, but things like wishful thinking approaches.
Maybe your dad will come back as a zombie.
But Paul, on the other hand, coldly shoots them down. He informs Jessica that all the Atreides forces will be wiped out. and that the Emperor and the Harkonnens will ensure that the Spacing Guild will not aid the Atreides in escaping.
Yeah, they're all going to die of dehydration inside of caves. What a shitty way to go.
Paul also tells Jessica that they're on their own. They will need to rely on themselves from here on out, and they need to get the family atomics.
Did he really say that right away? Like, we need to get the nukes. Like,
yes.
That's his first thought. We need to get those nukes.
So I took this to be that Paul is starting, like, he's had dreams of the future before, but now he's starting to have waking visions of the future. And the way I have always sort of imagined, they describe it in more detail, and I'll read some quotes about that. But basically, the way I imagine prescience in Dune, as it plays a big role in this book and the rest of the series, is that they're not like seeing the future in some kind of like mystical, magical way. They're computing the future. When you take the spice, it raises your awareness and your mental faculties to such an extent that you can begin to basically run simulations on a universal level. And different people have varying levels of prescient ability. And I always kind of viewed that as having more or less processing power to run your simulations. You can account for more and more variables. And I think Paul has begun running through all the various models and likely situations in his head. And he has formulated a plan or seen a result that he wants to work toward. And that result requires the family atomics. And he begins to awaken to a true prescient vision. And like I said, this is one of the key themes that defines Dune as a series. And I will read the direct quote here.
He remembered once seeing a gauze kerchief blowing in the wind, and now he sensed the future as though it twisted across the same surface. He saw people. He felt the heat and cold of uncounted probabilities. He knew names and places, experienced emotions without number, reviewed data of innumerable unexplored crannies. It's a weird thing to say. There was a time to probe and a time to test and taste. But no, he's talking like he's on a trip, but no time to shape. The thing was a spectrum of possibilities, from the most remote past to the most remote future, from the most probable to the most improbable, and he saw his own death in countless ways.
So now I would like to spend the next 3 hours talking about walking through the desert.
Yeah, we're not doing that. We're not even into part two yet, so we're gonna go ahead and fast forward this, okay? So let's start with the big plot twist, maybe, that Jessica, the Lady Jessica, is in fact the daughter of the Baron.
Dun, dun, dun!
Apparently, he allowed himself one time to have sex with an adult woman.
And he didn't care for it.
Yeah, but she was a Bene Gesserit. So she was able to manipulate the sperm into the egg, I guess?
Yeah, they can do that.
Cool. So Jessica was supposed to bear a daughter so that that daughter could be married off to Fade Rotha so that the two houses can be joined. But like, hey guys, Jessica was the daughter of the Baron. She could have just married the Duke. It's whatever. Maybe she was illegitimate. Whatever. Bene Gesserit are stupid. I guess. Don't try and correct me. I don't care. Let's go ahead and move on.
Well, I suppose we're just going to glance over the douche philosophy corner I had prepared, comparing Jessica and Paul's time spent in the desert to the adventures of...
As a matter of fact, we are definitely doing that. So we're going to move on. The next chapter deals with Thufir, who almost escapes, but then he doesn't, and he's captured. And he ends up replacing Peter or whatever as the Mentat for House Harkonnen, and he's fed a poison that will kill him if it's ever withdrawn. It doesn't sound like a poison to me, but whatever.
It's a poison that will kill him if he doesn't eat the antidote every day.
Oh, okay. fancy. Later, Gurney joins up with some smugglers in his quest for vengeance, and then he disappears for like 300 pages. So I mentioned those guys now so that we can just focus solely on Paul and Jess. Duncan Idaho comes back to rescue the two of them, and he brings them to Liet Kynes and his Freemen.
Fremen,
whatever. So Duncan has convinced Liet Kynes to join up with them just in time for the Sardaukor to barge in and kill Duncan. And Kynes gives them an ornithopter to escape, while he pretends he had nothing to do with anything. It was just totally innocent. And as I think about it, you know, you would think that's incredibly stupid. It would never work. But the Baron got away with that earlier. So maybe he thought, like, oh, the Baron's an idiot. He's gonna buy that I had nothing to do with this. Even though he's a crazy, jiggling psychopath who just murdered thousands of people.
Or maybe he was relying on his relationship with the Emperor to mean more than it did, because Liet Kynes is the official.
His status as the planetologist does not do anything to save his sorry ass from execution. So Jess and Paul are observed flying into a dust tornado, and Paul uses his super brain to just ride it out, but everyone thinks they're dead, so no one searches for them. Next, because the part just keeps going on forever, I guess I should mention now that Liet Kynes does in fact die in just a bit, but we're gonna just gonna ignore him, just assume he's dead now. The desert explodes on him. It's like a spice explodes underneath him and he dies.
He's definitely dead. So
but he has a conversation with his dead father first, because that was important.
Yes, the spice does, in fact, there's a something called, it's not spice yet, it's called a pre-spice mass, and that mass will detonate eventually, like it builds up pressure and then explodes outward, and that becomes spice.
Cool. Anyway, back to Paul and Jessica, and this, I counted, it's like 33 pages. I honestly thought this went on for 50 pages, and I heard that the book, quote, really picks up when they get to the desert. That's wrong. It was objectively untrue.
Did I say that?
It was either you, my dad, or both. But this fucking desert trek just goes on forever. So Paul learns that you have to walk without a rhythm as a way to not attract the sandworms. So he like walks, but he stops. He drags his foot. Like it just goes into detail on how he's not walking normal. And then there's a sand avalanche, and it buries all their supplies, but then they unbury them, and then they cross the desert, and then they lure the worm away with some noise that they make, and then it just goes on, and they make it across the desert, and they meet up, they find some Freemen, or Fremen, my bad.
It is your bad.
I'm just gonna go ahead and start on that too, or we're gonna be summarizing this book forever. For the end of time.
I mean,
so
why not?
So I'll be happy to summarize it for you. You're welcome. So Jessica and Paul, oh, I'm sorry, the Lady Jessica and Paul stumble into a Fremen encampment on the other side of the open desert. The Fremen see Paul and Jessica as free water for the taking, and the only thing in their way is that pesky whole, you know, being alive thing. So it's time to solve that. A guy named Stilgar and a guy named Jameis are among a troop that are ready to attack. So Jessica, like, easily subdues Stilgar, and Paul beats the shit out of Jameis and then noisily disappears into some nearby rocks. Like, as loud as possible, everyone can easily trace his location. He's not a ninja. He's not fooling anyone. So it is important to note here, okay? Jameis, he didn't lose. He merely failed to win. The sun was in his eyes. He didn't eat a good breakfast. He was tired at the time. Shoelaces were tied together. And he just got over a serious breakup. So that's why Paul easily defeated him. It won't happen again ever. Okay. After a tense standoff of back and forth negotiations, the stimulus bill for the coronavirus relief is... Oh, sorry. That's the news. No, after a tense standoff of back and forth negotiations, the tribe and Jessica, there we go, they decide to stand down after talking forever, after going back and forth between Democrats and Republicans. They finally get that sign. And during this encounter, we're also introduced to Chani, who, not really important right now, but does become important later, so just remember that. I'm gonna slow down here. I'm going to let you talk.
As I'm following along in my book, I noticed that Stilgar says, and Stilgar is going to be important, by the way, too, so remember that name. Great gods below, why didn't you say you were a weirding woman and a fighter? And that's kind of just how Stilgar talks. Like, he's kind of like a weird cartoon man. But
so is the Baron. So are a lot of people in this book.
What struck me is I remember thinking, like as I'm reading it just now, why are the gods like below? That's weird. And then I just now realized he's talking about the worms. The Fremen, the Fremen think the worms are like messengers of God. And you would perhaps know that if you hadn't skipped over the epic worm chase scene. Just made it disappear with some noise, you son of a bitch.
That's how I choose to remember it. You know, it'd be great if a giant worm just ate all of Congress. Anyway, let's move on.
Oh, your topical political humor.
I don't think that's topical. I think as soon as we had a Congress, someone was wanting a giant worm to eat them all. So Jameis is moaning and crying and bitching and carrying on. And, oh, this child bested me with his entire army at his back. I could have taken him and all of his goons, but, like, I let him strike first and give him a fighting chance. And
what are you talking about? What
also
goons?
Stilgar told
you saying,
me to lay down for him.
Are you saying that Jameis is saying that Paul had an army?
I'm saying that Jameis probably went back to his friends and went like, yeah, that child and his army beat my ass, but, like, you know, like, I gave him a fighting chance. Well, I could have taken all 500 of those ninjas. But
a couple scenes from now, we are going to see that Jameis has a lot of friends.
Yeah. Yes. And so, oh, God. Oh, my God. Okay.
I'm glad you got it.
So Jameis decides, like, you know, that fight doesn't count. I want a rematch to the death. I'm going to kill this child for kicking my ass. So he and Paul have what I can only describe as a slow motion, no contact dance that also happens to involve weapons.
Well, usually when it involves weapons, the first contact is the last contact. So you take a minute, get in there.
So Paul, he's used to fighting opponents who have shields. So he goes really slow because he needs to pass a blade through the shield and only slow strikes can get through. And Jameis is used to being shit and fighting opponents who are infirm or children. So finally, Paul is like, oh, I can swing a lot faster and a lot harder, and he just straight up murders this dude.
And don't you act like that's not the plot of every Dragon Ball Z arc there is. Oh, I can move faster and harder.
I just need to hit him a lot harder to win. So Stilgar is like, hey, you won't toy around with me when it's my turn to be murdered by you for command of the tribe. But things are smoothed over when he learns Paul didn't actually want to kill Jameis, even though Jameis had it coming. And Jessica, for her part, tries to make sure he doesn't get a liking for killing by asking Paul, how does it feel to be a murderer? So, A, Jessica, he already, right in front of you, kicked a man right into the aorta and exploded his heart. He's already killed someone. And B, like, fuck you? Like, I don't want to get ahead of ourselves. I mean, I do. It'd be great to just get to parts like 100 pages from now. But Jessica sucks. She is hot garbage. She only continues to be hot garbage. After bringing her son into this world, training him to be a murderer and then berating him for being a murderer. She poisons her daughter in the womb with space drugs. But we'll get to that. I think that I've done a good job speeding this up, so I'm going to turn it over to you.
So I actually checked, and that was about 250 pages of Dune. You just breezed through in a few minutes. And I think now we're going to spend a long time talking about Fremen burial customs because, one, they're neat, and two, I didn't much care for your tone. So now you got to sit through this.
Okay.
But no, seriously, I don't know if I noticed it on the first read through or not, but yeah, like Paul definitely has already, he kicked someone to death without even thinking about it. You didn't even remember.
Like, yeah.
that's how unimportant that guy was to you, Jessica. What are you talking about? Yeah, Paul's been training to knife fight for the last like 15 years. What are you doing? So yeah, it's interesting. I did actually seriously want to talk about Fremen burial customs.
I actually did not despise this part. I thought this was more interesting than the fucking trek through the desert. So I'll give you that much. This is something I did find interesting.
I know we talked a little bit on the side and you said that you feel like maybe my brain has just filtered it down to the good bits in my memory.
Yes.
And this is one of the things I definitely do remember very clearly is just the phrase, and like I've given this quote to like other Dune fans many, many times, is that a man's flesh is his own, but the water belongs to the tribe. When Jaymis dies, and now Jaymis has been with these people way longer than Paul or Jessica, but because this was an official duel, that's just the way it is. The Fremen are like, okay, he made his challenge, he lost, sucks, but that's life in the desert.
Go get the blender.
And I don't know exactly, they don't really describe exactly what technology they use, but somehow
it's the juicer from Futurama.
Yeah, Fremen have a technology that extracts all the moisture from the human body and turns it into drinkable water. And a portion of Jaymis' water goes to the tribe, and a portion goes to Paul for being the one to take him out, as are the rules. And in addition to that, they have a funeral for Jaymis, where all of Jaymis's worldly possessions and some things that probably shouldn't be Jaymis's possessions are put up for grabs by the tribe. And Paul, there's a touching scene where people go up and they say, like, I was a friend of Jaymis. He did this cool thing for me at this random's place, and I'm taking his coffee pot. That it happened. So spice coffee is a very important thing, and it tastes like cinnamon, so I think I made the joke that it's just pumpkin spice. So they divvy up Jaymis's worldly possessions, and Paul realizes he's going to be expected to take something too, and he's like, well, how the hell do I say I'm a friend of Jaymis? I killed him. So Paul's like, I was a friend of Jaymis. He taught me that when you kill somebody, there is always a cost, and I'm taking his guitar. And he takes Jaymis's guitar.
And also he's like, I'm going to take his wife too.
I'm getting there.
And his kids.
I'm getting
those
there.
Are mine.
I'm getting there. So Paul sheds a tear because just he is able to, in this moment, feel some actual human emotion again, and seeing all these people whose friend he just killed, even though the guy was a jackass.
He couldn't feel anything for his dad, who loved him for 15 years.
He does,
but
eventually.
This asshole.
He does eventually. You skipped over that as well. Where
good.
Paul makes his plans and then does have an emotion that he is finally able to grieve for his dad. But you skipped that. That's on you. So when Paul cries for Jaymis, he sheds like two tears. The Fremen are stunned that Paul, and this is another Dune quote that Dune fans will trade, Paul gave water to the dead. In a culture where like water is literally money,
poured some out for his homies.
Well, even the smallest amount of liquid water is incredibly precious, and for Paul to just waste it on Jameis showed immense respect for Jameis, which is, I don't think at all Paul's intention, but he rolls with that. He's really good at it.
Yeah.
And another thing I wanted to mention, I did briefly say that, you know, Stilgar recognizes that Jessica's a Bene Gesserit. The priestesses in the Fremen religion are called Sayyadinas, and Jessica is given sort of a test by Stilgar to see if she's actually what she claims to be. And Jessica, again, has to bluff, similarly to what she did with the Shout Out Mapes. She has to try to figure out exactly what the Fremen religion is and try to fudge it. And she's able to do that because the Fremen religion is based on, I don't want to say lies spread by the Bene Gesserit, but heavily inspired by the Bene Gesserit Missionaria Protectiva, which is the religious engineering wing of the Bene Gesserit. And if that sounds kind of shady, it is. And so she is able to guess sort of what flavor of religion was sowed on Arrakis.
Judaism.
No. You get two more guesses and I bet you'll get it, but we're not going to go there. She guesses and she figures out it's kind of a mixture of like, you know, Islam and some other like religion that was popular with like hunter-gatherer nomad type peoples. So she fudges it. She talks her way into being a Sayyadina. She tricks them into thinking she's trick is a strong word, but yeah, she tricks them into thinking she's.
This is the case where everyone around her becomes dumber.
And the other thing I wanted to mention is Jessica's almost loses it, but there is one kind of quasi mystical thing that does come up again and again in the Dune series, and that is the concept of adab. I don't know if I'm saying that correctly, but it's the demanding memory, they call it. And Dune is really big on this notion that sort of we have access to our genetic or ancestral memory, that we can access the some, I don't want to say like instance of the people before us, but like some of their essence is still with us. Everybody who contributed to our genetic makeup. And drawing upon that, Jessica is inspired to give her actual defense of herself and her son, and they are accepted into the tribe. So Nate, do you have any bits you wanted to add about this? I know you rushed through it and would probably like to keep rushing.
Yeah, no, I'm good. I guess they pour a bunch of his water into like a hole in the ground. Is that what that is?
It's called a quanaut, I think. The Fremen have, as it turns out, the Fremen have a surprising amount of water. And they catch a small amount of atmospheric moisture through wind traps. And they also, I don't know, I mean, make use of every drop they can get. And their goal here is actually to follow Liet Kynes' plan to terraform Arrakis. So everything that they suspected about Dune was in fact correct, that there are millions of Fremen, not a few hundred, and that they are kind of a technological force to be reckoned with. They are hoarding massive quantities of water for the purpose of terraforming Dune. And they can store it in this quanaut, which is also kind of like a bank. They give you water rings. And, you know, when you want to withdraw your water, you can come exchange a ring for like a gallon of water. I don't know. But Paul gives his water rings to Chani to hold on to, which everybody giggles at because they're like, oh, he gave his water rings to a girl, which means he likes her.
And Paul had no fucking clue.
No, he had no idea. That's just like the only person who wasn't a total asshole to him.
This is true.
But Paul has also seen Chani in his visions before, so I think that's part of the reason he feels like he can trust her. Fremen custom dictates that within the tribe, you must have a name that only the tribe may use. So this is a secret name that you tell no one outside your tribe. And Paul is given by Stilgar the name Usul, which means like very strong, possibly bear-like. Paul then chooses a name that he will use to communicate with the outside world. And he doesn't want to give up his own name entirely, so he chooses to keep Paul, but in place of Atreides, he asks what the strange desert mouse that he's seen running around is. And they stare at him like, oh, that's also very profound. That's a very wise thing for you to choose. We call that wise one or something. And its name in their language is Muad'Dib. And Paul is henceforth known as Paul Muad'Dib. There is one thing I want you to talk about as my Baron.
Oh God.
we'll go back to my brain only remembering the good bits. This is one thing I actually almost forgot. Tell me what it was like to watch Fade Rautha murder that slave that you had drugged to be not as good as he might have been.
What the fuck was the point of that? All right, everyone, we're going to show what a great combatant Fade Rautha is. He's going to fight a guy who's high as balls using one sword and then another sword dipped in poison like just a cheating motherfucker. And oh, but this time, Thufir has convinced Fade that we're going to replace the slave master, I guess, by not drugging the slave as much. and we're going to condition him that when you say a word, he's going to get locked up or something. But Fade, his super secret plan within this plan is he's going to put the poison on the other sword. Then he kills him, and that's it. What the fuck was the point of that?
Basically, there's this random chapter that introduces a lot of people. Like you mentioned at the beginning, I think Count Fenring. This is kind of Count Fenring's shining moment.
Yes. He does a lot of... he has a lot of weird, like, tics and vocal changes, and it's described as like it's a secret code to his wife, but he comes off as like a fucking loony or like someone who has Tourette's. he has Tourette's is what it sounds like.
Oh my goodness.
Or perhaps he's on an antipsychotic and the dose is too high.
A distinct possibility.
Anyway, go on. Tell us about Count Fenring.
I'm not going to tell you about Count Fenring. So this chapter is...
But he's such an important character, Ben.
I do actually remember this chapter. I didn't even need to reread it because even the first time I read the book, I was like, what the fuck is this?
I thought that we were going to get like, okay, you're going to start showing us more character development from Fade Rautha. No, yeah.
That's exactly what I thought too. So they start this chapter and it takes place on Geti Prime, which is the homeworld of the Harkonnens. And Fade Rautha, apparently one of the things he likes to do, some kids play soccer, some kids play baseball, some kids murder weakened slaves in their father's fighting pits. Sorry, everybody. So Fade traditionally fights with two daggers, which is important for some reason. And like Nate said, one of the daggers is poisoned. And it's always like this one dagger, but like this time he poisons like the other dagger, which is like, whoa.
What a sneaky snake.
Yeah, I don't get it. It seems like they're trying to do, like, I'm going to say this goes back to Dune being released as a serial publication where... I think maybe it's to borrow another anime analogy, it's like the My Hero Academia thing where they say, there's a traitor in UA, and then they just kind of forgot, and they never do anything with it. I think this is just the result of like making it up as you go, and sometimes plot threads get lost, and I think that's kind of Fade Rautha in general, is just a plot thread that didn't make it, but didn't get cut.
Well... He just needed another 200 pages to really flesh out the character.
So the other thing that's going on here is Count Fenring's wife is Bene Gesserit. And the Bene Gesserit have sent her there to try to get knocked up by Fade Rautha.
How lovely.
And
right?
They want her to do that because they're afraid that the Atreides and the Harkonnens are about to totally kill one another, and they need to salvage the DNA for the breeding program.
There are other ways to salvage DNA, one. And two...
Okay, well...
I'm just shocked that everyone goes along with this. Like, hey, yeah, I'm Space Pope here, and we want your wife to fuck this guy who is a psychopath and get some of that sweet, sweet semen.
So here's the thing, and this is, I know I keep referencing the other books.
Yes, you mentioned that you defend a lot of this book with later books in the series.
The Bene Gesserit have a, ironically, an almost religious belief that genetic engineering is immoral. And so...
What?
Yeah. So while they...
What? Fuck you. What?
They have the technology. Like, the Bene Gesserit know how to and very easily could genetically engineer people rather than breeding them. They think that is more demeaning than breeding them.
It's more demeaning than having a psychopath fuck your wife.
I'm not saying they're right. I'm not saying I'm not endorsing it, Nate. I'm just the Bene Tleilax, the evil Bene Tleilax, are the
genetic, are they evil?
They're pretty bad. But they're genetic engineers.
Are they any worse than the Bene Gesserit though?
Yeah. Yeah, they
oh
are.
Oh my god. How
they're pretty bad. The Bene Gesserit get better. And also I want to mention one more time, the breeding program, as far as I could tell, is I don't want to say consensual because they kind of groom these people, but
yes, you're my brood mother.
Yeah,
you're
it's not great.
You're gonna go in there, you're gonna consensually get knocked up, but we've been conditioning you to want to get knocked up for the past however many years. Is that consensual?
No, it's not great. It's hard to defend. It was a different time, Nate. It was 1965. People were doing spice and free love was in the air. Not free per se, but strictly regulated. No, a lot of people hate the Bene Gesserit for that, and they do get into some of the problems of the Bene Gesserit doing that. But again, like the other big theme of Dune is sort of like, what could you do? What could humanity do if it really used all the tools at its disposal to push itself to the limit? And I think the Bene Gesserit's take on it is that there is still some deference to nature in their process, whereas genetic engineering is something that the machine mind would think of.
Heaven forbid.
It's deeply, deeply flawed thinking, but...
Their master plan to have Jessica bear a daughter so that psychopath Fade Rotha can abuse that daughter. But it will totally fix this rift between House Harkonnen and House Atreides.
Well, I imagine they would probably kill Fade Rotha after he sired the daughter. The Bene Gesserit kind of do that sometimes, too.
Do they breed the child to bite the head off the father?
No, I mean,
eat
just
his
like,
corpse for if, sustenance.
If like, okay, you saw Jessica beat the shit out of Stilgar, right? So they're not helpless. Like Fade Rautha would have a very hard time. Like the Bene Gesserit aren't drugged slaves that he can just stab with poison. They're fucking space ninjas. So they
except
could
for Paul.
They could just easily kill him if he started abusing them, and their all I can say is in future books their plans are a lot more competent.
Yeah, we spent a long time on this fucking chapter. The other important part about this chapter is that Baron is like, hey, you know Arrakis, we could turn that into a prison planet. And Count Fenrir is like, absolutely not. Don't ever think of that again. Also, I'm reporting this to the Emperor. Good day, sir.
Another part of Dune's sort of pushing humanity to its limits and going beyond them is the idea that tough environments make for tough people. And I don't know if that's how that works, but I don't
know.
That's
how that works.
I don't know if harsh living conditions and malnutrition actually do make for Olympic athletes.
Malnutrition actually makes you more susceptible to plague, so you know.
Yeah, it's a fun thought for somebody who's never been to a desert.
or who probably never worked out or anything ever in his life, you know.
I've never actually seen a picture of Frank Herbert standing up. So I think really the last thing I want to get to here is a good old-fashioned Fremen CH Spice Orgy.
Well, before you get into that, you have to talk about Jessica.
What about her?
Or I can talk about Jessica.
Why don't you tell me about Jessica?
All right. So they decide that she's going to become the high priestess or whatever it's called.
Sayadina?
No. Doesn't she go from Sayadina to whatever... okay, hold
Super
on.
Super Sayadina? I had to.
A Reverend Mother. That's what it is.
Oh, well, yeah. Do they actually call them... Do the Fremen call
yes!
them Reverend Mothers?
Yes! Yes! That's the whole thing. She becomes a Reverend Mother.
I mean, I know that's what the process they're about to do makes her. I know it makes her a Reverend Mother, but I didn't.
No, they call it that.
Okay.
She becomes a Sayadina, and then she immediately powers up and becomes Reverend Mother, like right after that. So the previous Reverend Mother of the tribe, she's like, all right, you want to become the Reverend Mother?
I'm old as shit. Let's do this.
Yeah, she is ancient. She's like, I'm not going to survive the next time we leave this siege. So here's the plan. You're going to become the Reverend Mother, even though you've been here for like 2 days, maybe a week. You're going to become our most important holy. You're going to become the Pope, basically.
Well, now hold up. They're both Bene Gesserit.
Yeah.
So they have that, like they're both kind of in on it. It's not like...
Oh, she also bullshit her way into it.
Yeah. Like, they both know what the deal is.
So she's like, all right, well, I'm going to die. But before you become Reverend Mother, you've got to unlock all your ancestral memory.
And so part of the Reverend Mother ceremony is she unlocks her own ancestral memories and she gets the memories of the previous Reverend Mother.
So in order to do this, they bring out this water that is just... deadly poisonous, and she has to drink the water and convert it into non-poisonous, delicious spice water.
I forget, did they tell you how they make the poison water?
I
know how they do it, but I don't remember if it's in this book or not.
Just go ahead and tell us. And I'll tell you if I know that.
They take a pool of water, and this is something only the Fremen know, by the way. Sandworms are allergic to water. It will dissolve them, literally.
Yeah, so that wasn't in this book.
They take a baby sandworm, like one that's still about like only maybe 2 feet long, and they drown it.
Jesus.
And it dissolves in the water, and that's what she drinks. Because the sandworms
Delicious.
Are basically made of the spice. And one more thing I wanted to add.
No, that was not in this book, by the way.
Paul is eating a ton of spice right now because it's a staple of the Fremen diet.
And that's why he awakens?
Well, he knows that the spice is having an effect on his consciousness. It's enhancing it, and it's enhancing it to a degree he's afraid he might not be able to control. And so leading up to this, Paul is kind of conscious of his spice intake, and is afraid he might put him over the edge.
That sounds like someone else we know from another book I'm not allowed to mention. Except this one's written a lot better.
Except instead of like reading Wikipedia, it's doing awesome drugs. I think I know which book I want to read.
So she drinks this poisonous water, and the Reverend Mother's like, yeah, just like that. Now you just have to convert. Wait, hold on. What the fuck? You're pregnant? Like, what the fuck? You're drinking fucking like cocaine laced water. You're going to have a drug baby. What the fuck is wrong with you, lady? Oh my God. And Jessica's like, yeah, I'm a shitty parent. I guess it's too late now, though. We really need our place in this tribe to be cemented. So, like...
So Jessica felt like...
I'm a drinking.
I'm going to give Jessica a little more of a break than that. It's a dumb
Please
decision.
Don't. Yeah, it's horrendously dumb. And she even thinks about it before she drinks it. Like, man, I'm going to fuck up this child.
So Jessica has relatively good reason to believe that if she doesn't soon cement her place in the tribe, somebody is going to assassinate her and Paul. And Stilgar is sort of trying to shield them from that, but there is a growing discontent for their presence. And
oh, please give that Stilgar quote.
Oh, no. So
yep.
Stilgar does have some of the best dialogue in literary history. There's a... I'm scrolling through my highlights. Frank Herbert, and again, I'm going to defend this book with the other books, he gets better. he becomes a better writer, but for this book, and kind of in future books, he has this like, there, you're always going to be told in any writing or movie or any kind of art class, you know, it's better to show than to tell. And that's part of the reason I sort of scolded Nate at the beginning of this when he's like, oh, there's all these weird words. I'm like, well, you know, that's how you learn language. You go to a place where you don't know the language and you sort of pick it up. And it's really cool when an author can just use that subtlety and immersion to build a world around you.
Or, hold on, or you can go to a place and then just expect them to use English, which is what they do in Japan, apparently, because I got around just fine.
Or you could be Nate, if that's the image of America you want them to
Everyone should go to Japan at least once, just not right now, for obvious reasons.
So my point with that long preamble is that Frank Herbert has a tendency to tell you in very simple words exactly what somebody is thinking. I will now read one of Nate and I's favorite passages from Dune.
The Sayadina, he said, our Reverend Mother is old. The Reverend Mother? Before she could probe this, he said, now I do not necessarily offer myself as mate. Like, this is nothing personal, for you are beautiful and desirable, and you should totally become one of my women, but that might lead to some of my young men believing that I'm too much concerned with pleasures of the flesh and not enough concerned with the tribe's needs. And even now, they listen and watch us. A man who weighs his decisions, who thinks of the consequences, she thought.
Is that an exact quote?
It's pretty close.
You sounded like a surfer dude from the 90s.
I mean, he doesn't say it with that accent, but I did.
I hope he does, actually.
And that's Jessica thinking about Stilgar saying, now, don't be offended that I didn't want to fuck you right here in the doorway. It's not that you're not hot, because you are. It's just that I don't think it would be appropriate. And Jessica's like, that's really...
He's achieved enlightenment.
That's so smart. Because, you know, a lot of people wouldn't do that. But you did that. And, like, wow. And then Stilgar goes on to say, I'm just going to keep going because it just keeps getting better. This is Stilgar again. I'll let you know with my voices.
The law that demands our form of choosing a leader is a just law. But it does not follow that justice is always the thing that a people needs. What we truly need now
is some hot ass.
Is time to grow and prosper, to spread our force over more land. Jesus Christ, Stilgar, buy me dinner first. What is his ancestry? She wondered. This is the exact quote. Whence comes such breeding?
Ah. I remember this, actually.
She said,
I remember going, ah.
Stilgar, I underestimated you.
Oh, you're giving me the vapors.
I'll just let you know, because I know you guys are all on the edge of your seats because you don't read the books. But yeah, they don't actually get together. Jessica does not get with Stilgar, fortunately.
And it's not because she's not hot, okay?
Oh my God, did we forget to say that Paul inherits Jamis's wife?
No, I mentioned it briefly. Paul inherits Jamis's wife, but keeps her as a servant, not as a wife. And then he also gets his kids, one of which is not one of Jamis's natural born kids.
Yeah, so Paul has to raise these two kids, and the lady who was Jamis's wife's like, I could be your wife too. And Paul's like, no. She's like, I'm not too old. I could give you many sons. And Paul's like, I don't think so. No, I'm going to go with Channy. You can still live here, though. Like, it's... bye. Anyway, so yeah, Jessica takes a bunch of drugs while she's pregnant. So the Reverend Mother asks Jessica, like, why didn't you tell us you were pregnant? And so I could excuse Jessica for feeling like she had to do this, but The old lady does raise a good point that maybe they wouldn't have pressured her into this if she'd mentioned to anybody that she was pregnant. Now, there's one more thing that I want to reiterate, and that is that Bene Gesserit do have mastery of their internal body chemistry. She is able to control the way she metabolizes toxins, I guess, for lack of a better word.
Crack. And,
worm juice.
Space crack.
So she has some reason to think she could maybe just tank this. I don't know your medical words. And so she's...
I'm going to use that.
Yeah, the Reverend Mother's like, well, buckle up. Hopefully we can save the fetus. And the two enter into this like epic meditation sequence where they're like trying to metabolize the toxins, and the Jessica can feel the connection to her unborn child. She could feel her the three beings, Jessica, the Reverend Mother, and the child.
The fetus.
Saint Alia of the knife.
Is it a fetus? Is it not an embryo at this point?
I'll admit, like, I didn't hate the desert part as much as you did, but I have no idea how much time has passed. I was shocked she was still pregnant.
I think that all that was like a week.
Wow.
Yeah, yeah, I think
it did feel like months. But Jessica realizes that the process of becoming a Reverend Mother that's happening to Jessica is also happening to the child. This child is going to be born a fully, like, more than sentient being with its complete ancestral memory, knowing all human knowledge, basically. Jessica then, she's able to metabolize it. She gets the old lady's memories. I think the old lady just quietly dies or something.
Yes, she stops existing.
And then Jessica, this is kind of gross.
Who wants an orgy?
Jessica, well, that's not even where I was going.
Oh,
that's okay. Hot. No, Jessica, like, she metabolizes the spice water within her own body, right? And then she, like, regurgitates it.
Oh, yeah.
And then that's what everybody drinks.
You don't want to waste that water.
Ben.
Yeah, but, like, it's purified because Jessica is, like, a human Brita
filter. Could she do that?
And that's what
they're
doing.
Drink urine and then just, like,
whoop, yeah, she
done. Here's some water.
Yeah.
If she had enough components, could she make pancakes within herself?
So that's getting into Bene Tlalak stuff, and we're not ready for that yet. It's not inconceivable that the Bene Tlalaks could make pancakes in their axolotl tanks.
I don't want to know what an axolotl tank is.
No, you don't. No one does. But when you find out, you're going to be like, wow, bro. Anyway, Jessica barfs up the acid tablets, and everybody takes a hit, and we do the ritual religious Fremen bonding exercise of this is sort of the Fremen version of a Catholic communion. But way cooler.
Take of my flesh,
baby. And they just yeah. Do it. And so there is a spice orgy, and this is the first time Paul hooks up with Chani.
Hey Chani, I want to show you my dark secret. Or my dark purpose. Oh, yes. This was promptly followed by... Wait, how long have we known each other? Followed by just a hard dicky.
It was followed by, how long have we known each other? I don't know, Chani. It feels like fucking months. Let's do this. We're the only two people approximately our age in this entire book, so... Oh, except true. Fade. You can be with Fade if you want, but I wouldn't recommend it. Watch out for one or the other of his daggers. It's slightly more deadly than the other. I like how he's gonna knife a guy to death, but like, I put the poison on the other. They're both deadly weapons, you dumbass.
They're both knives, okay?
If you stab me with the non-poison one, it's not that much better.
So, on that note, we're going to wrap up next week, and it is next week, not 2 weeks from now. We will be finishing Dune. God, I hope we're finishing Dune next week. Please, God, let me finish Dune next
week. I promise, barring some sort of deep in the crease situation, we will be finishing Dune next week.
And then we will give closing thoughts, and then we will move on from Dune for now. And then after that, we are reading The Murder of Roger Ackroyd by Agatha Christie, a murder mystery. Ben, who's the murderer? Do you know yet?
I currently suspect everyone, though I think, so I'm about 25% of the way through it, and you told me to record what I thought at each level. I'm about 25% of the way through. Roger Ackroyd has just recently died, and I suspect it was a woman.
All right. Well, we will see for sure when we read that book. And I guess I should say, since it's a mystery, there will be spoilers, but we will try to contain them to the end. All right. I'm done. Later.
Speaking of moral high horses, the Baron briefly mentions that he's also giving up the opportunity to rape Paul. So,
God, that's so gross. The Barons, they're both so fucked up.
Bold stance, Nate.
Raping so children is bad. I'm going to go on record for that one. Yeah, if you have a kid in for longer than about 42 weeks, it comes out looking overdone.
I don't know what that means. Like a ham?
Yeah, that's good.
I honestly have no idea what that could mean. Or it's like a grown woman doing the... Either way, this kid's overdubbed, and it's just... This is how the voice sounds.
Oh, Baron, you should be careful. My brother's coming for you.
Maybe it's a man playing her.
It could have been me. It's like, that's what it sounds like.
Oh, I just looked up what an axolotl tank was. Oh, God.
But the point is, you could probably make pancakes in there.
Oh, my God. Jesus Christ.